Good evening. I'm K2 Kilowatt. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. And along with K2 Kilowatt Echo Yankee, his name is Mel. My name is Dick. The two of us attempt to organize a thing called the Technical Net.
Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
At 8 o'clock, right now. The Technical Net major purpose is education. Mel and Dick gather the amateur radio clan. And we help each other. We help each other understand how radio propagation works, how antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers, how all this stuff works, the 26 different kinds of ham radio. 25 of them are different than this one, which is a 2-meter FM repeater ham radio. There's 25 other kinds. And if this one doesn't quite please you, try one of the others. Mel and Dick occasionally handle some emails that he gets, but that's not our major purpose. The major purpose of the TechNet is a live answer on the spot. The subjects that are discussed are 95% of the time the subjects that you bring to the net as a question. Once in a while we have a prepared subject, and if there's a whole lot of free time tonight, I'm going to tell you about a often misunderstood concept about the way radio waves propagate. Linear propagation, circular polarization, and so on. There's a couple of concepts that are very frequently misunderstood. The diagrams that are given in the textbooks and the articles that we write don't clear up this particular subject. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, try to remember to give us your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So, who would like to check in, give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Joe. Yes. Paul. And yes.
Okay, we got Joe and Paul. Please repeat your call letters.
Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform.
Okay, Whiskey Victor 2 Uniform. Paul and Joe. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WA2 Victor David Henry John. Yes.
Very fine, John. Well done. So far we've got Paul, Joe, and John. Anyone else?
KC2L2IS.
KC2 sounds like Lima Tango Yankee. You said it so fast, you didn't give me phonetics, and you didn't give me a name. Mr. LTY, question mark, go right ahead.
Yeah, the name is Rich, you got the call right.
Very fine, Rich. Okay, one more call. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
JC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
Okay, Steve with a no. But if we get some really juicy subjects, maybe that'll turn into a yes. One last call. Anyone else? Okay, Joe, you were the first one that I heard, and what's new in your neighborhood? W-E-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Okay, good evening, Dick there, W-E-2-R-Y-Y here. I just recently got a hold of a beam that works on 420 to 440, and it made some measurements on it, physical measurements, and I'm kind of wondering why on the driven element I'm pointing a little bit of a difference between the two ends of the dipoles, which have insulators on both sides. One is, even though one is rounded at the boom and one is directly to the center connection of the end female connector on it. They only differ by about a quarter of an inch or so, but I'm just wondering why a manufacturer would do that. Is there a specific reason? This is a commercially made beam.
Now, the non-symmetry of the element you're discussing, is it the driven element or is it one of the parasitic elements? You said the elements are insulated from the boom. Are they thoroughly insulated from the boom or only partially insulated? And is this also the driven element? Clear up some of those issues there, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, I didn't say driven element, but I thought you would assume that if it has a connection to an RF port, that it would be the driven element. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. There are insulators on both sides of the elements going into the boom assembly, which is actually a attached to the boom. It's not like that is not welded. That's actually movable back and forth. But the driven element on each side is not exactly symmetrical. They differ by about an eighth of an inch, maybe slightly longer between one to the other. Like one side's about five and a half inches, and one like five and a quarter or something like that. I look at my notes to see the exact specific measurements I made out of thing. And I also noticed there's a difference between the dimension between the driven element and the first director and the reflector. It's quite a difference. The first director is much, much closer than the reflector happens to be.
Okay, there's an infinite number of Yagi designs. However, one of the major factors that is almost common with most of the designs is the driven element and director spacing is much, much smaller than the driven element to reflector spacing. Many, many of the designs have that phenomenon. Now, the driven element itself, Joe, how is it fed? T-match, gamma match, delta match, folded dipole, directly driven with a ballon. Tell me the nature of how the RF energy gets onto the first, onto the driven element. Back to you, Joe.
Probably called direct connection because there is a direct connection between the center of the N female connector to one element, and the other element goes directly to the boom or to the ground side of the connector. There is no capacitor in series that I can tell. Well, obviously, because it's zero continuity, zero ohms continuity between the center pin and one element. Don't know if there's a capacitor inside this assembly or not. You can't take this thing apart to really look at it. It seems like the element goes one to one side of the connector, one goes to the other side of the connector. And the side that's, I call the hot side, is actually slightly shorter than the other side.
Okay, so what I think I'm hearing is that it's a coaxial cable bringing RF energy up to the driven element. Center conductor of the coaxial cable seems to be feeding the right-hand half of the driven element dipole. The shield of the coax cable sounds like it's feeding the left-hand side of the half of the driven element dipole. Is there any kind of a balloning device? Is any of the shield or driven elements grounded to the boom anywhere? What is choking the RF energy from crawling back down the outside of the coax cable, Joe? Back to you, Joe, KQRIW.
There is no ballon, and the hot, I look at my measurements I have here, the hot side, for this is the edge of the insulator going out to the end of the element is 5.5 inches, and on the ground side, that's the longer side, is 5 5/8 inches. There is no ballon on this as far as I can tell. It's a simple N-female connection, N-female connector, where you put your transmission line to.
Okay, you said ground side. Now, there's an ambiguity there. The shield of the coax cable, some people will call that the ground side. Maybe there's a UHF or a type N connector with some kind of a bracket mounted right at the boom. And maybe that is grounded to the boom. And the non-hot side of the driven element, is it, how is it connected back to the connector? And is it grounded? I guess I'm really asking, is the driven element truly floating, or is only half of the driven element floating from the boom with insulators? Back to you, Joe.
The driven element is grounded to the boom on one side, but it has an insulator on that side, but it's apparently grounded inside the assembly where the coax cable connects to the transmission line connects to the driven element assembly. There is no ballon.
Okay. The coax cable goes into an assembly. That assembly has what dimensions? Is it 4 inches long and a half inch square or something like that? Describe that assembly to me, Joe, and I obviously you can't see what's inside of it, but that could be a ballooning device. Back to you, Joe.
Well, it resembles a T-connector in a roundabout way, where you'd have an N-female port connector on one end, and the driven elements come out of the other sides of it, but they have insulators. They have actually looks like some sort of plastic type of insulation between the driven element and touching this assembly. Now, as Sal said again, the driven element it's hot on one side, goes to the center connector. That's the shorter side. The longer side goes to the ground side of the connector, or the boom, or however it's attached to the antenna. It's all the same resistance, but basically 0 ohms. Same thing with the driven, the hot side of the driven element. That also has 0 ohms for the center pin of the end connector, the end female connector.
Okay. One other crazy piece of information. If I took the mounting plate of the type N female input connector, from that mounting plate, if I'm measuring parallel to the boom, the dimension, the spacing, from the mounting plate of that input connector to the center line of the driven element, what's that approximate distance, Joe?
Let's see. The center of the connector to the center line of the driven element, well, maybe about an inch, inch and a quarter, something like that. And this whole assembly mounts around the boom itself, so it actually makes the driven element slightly not in line with all the other elements, but only slightly.
Not in line, meaning it's mounted above the boom. I know that the left to right, one side of the driven element is longer than the other. But, okay, so from the flat plate that the type N connector, the UG58, is screwed down to, if I measure, put my tape measure parallel to the boom, and I measure from that flat plate that mounts the UG58 to the center line of the driven element, I think you said that's about an inch. Is that what you said, Joe? Go ahead.
Well, it's a formed assembly. It's not something like you're describing. You think it's like a flat plate. It's not a flat plate. There's no corners on the thing. It's really just like a form type of assembly where it has a hole on one end where the end female connector goes into, and the other side of it is where the driven element and comes out of both sides. It looks like a T connector.
Okay, what brand name is this antenna, Joe?
I can't tell that exactly. I believe it's a cell wave type of antenna.
Okay, I think I've seen that one. If you did take apart that assembly that goes between the type N connector and the driven element, I think you would find let me backtrack now. It's like a T connector. The two halves of the driven element come out of each side of the T connector. The hot side, obviously, is insulated. Is the cold side insulated, or does the driven element on the cold side directly connect to the metallic case that includes the input type N connector? Back to you, Joe.
No, that's where it looks like it's a little different. It has the same kind of insulator on both sides of the driven element, but if you do a continuity check, there is zero continuity between that element, or I call it ground side, and the case of this type of whatever this housing is that the coax connector goes into.
I think I've seen that there, Keith, KEY.
Yeah. He finally gave us the magic words. It really is insulated on each side. When he said one side is grounded, he kept saying grounded as if his eye would see grounding. He didn't tell us. He kept the secret. The fact that the grounding he measured with his ohm meter, whereas...
I did tell you that.
You told me with an ohm meter. You kept saying the word grounded, and I expected to see something physically grounded on that side. But, and now I understand. So it's grounded by way of your ohm meter, but it looks like each half of the dipole is floating. Inside of that assembly, you're going to see a U-shaped piece of metal. You're going to see that the driven element of the... input coax cable, so to speak, is bridging the gap across that U-shaped piece of element. The U-shaped piece of element, the tops of the U are connecting to the left and the right side of the dipole. The input RF energy is bridging the gap, somewhat like what you do with a J-pole feeding mechanism. I've got a bunch of more guesses as to what's going on and why it's non-symmetric. Let me pass it over to Mel, because he's seen the exact thing. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's what I was just going to describe, exactly what you just mentioned, Vic. I say the words right out of my mouth. Yeah, that looks like they have this, I guess you could talk about some of them, big old antenna systems. This is, I think, a system that was pioneered by Mosley, where he makes that little contraption up that goes in the center, where the elements go on each side. It's a molded block and has a end connector that's actually part of that block that's actually molded in, or some way he managed to cast that into the block or maybe threaded it in, you know, I don't know. But some way they got that end connector in the center. And if you look, they have from there, there's like a rod, a piece of cable that goes out from that point, from the center of the connector, one element, and then the other side goes out to the other side. That would be where you would see the shield connected. And then it's insulated from the boom. Basically, that's way Mosley has several versions of that over.
Very fine. You're a little bit noisy into the machine tonight, Mel, so I bring that to your attention, as if you're not giving it quite as much energy, or is picking up some local static. This also is very close to being a hairpin feeding mechanism. There are people who will split the driven element into two halves of a dipole, insulate it from the boom, put a U-shaped piece of wire between the two halves. That becomes a hairpin. That becomes a shunt inductor. By making the dipole a little bit shorter than resonance, the dipole becomes capacitive. The shunt inductor corrects for that capacitive reactance, making it a pure 50-ohm load. And across the U-shape or across the hairpin is where the RF energy shield versus semiconductor is being fed. And the length of the dipole is what determines how capacitive and whether or not it properly resonates with that hairpin device, that U-shape device. The exact symmetry of the driven element, you've got a lot of freedom there. Everyone believes that a dipole must be fed in the exact center. Nothing could be further from the truth. A Carolina Wyndham dipole, for instance, often used on HF for multi-frequency use, is fed way off to one side. As long as you've got the right kind of impedance matching device, you can feed the dipole anything from the end, 10% from the end, 25% from the middle, left side, right side, whichever. There's nothing magic about feeding the exact center of the dipole, depending on the kind of balloning device you're using. The kind of balloning device, this hairpin device, tends to end up a little bit hotter on the side that's fed by the semiconductor versus the side that's fed by the shield. It becomes a little bit non-symmetric. By repositioning the dipole, you make that all come out right. If you did an experiment by putting that driven element assembly on some kind of a rack and pinion like thing where you could slide it left and right, assume the boom is aimed dead north, and you could slide the driven element to the east and to the west, you would find on 440 megacycles, 430 megacycles, you could slide that probably 3 or 4 inches before you would measure any significant change in pattern, gain, spanning wave ratio, whatever. The way a dipole radiates, let me drop, it radiates primarily broadside. If you could see the pattern in three-dimensional space, it would look like a very fat donut with the wire, so to speak, of the dipole going through the hole of the donut. And that very broad pattern is such that it doesn't have to be thoroughly symmetric with the rest of the parasitic elements. The parasitic elements themselves, you could juggle them left and right on 440 megacycles, about an inch, nothing would happen. You could also, if you were building your Yagi as I did, where each of the driven elements was sitting in a plastic block, and the plastic block was sitting on top of the boom, and each plastic block was being held down with a tie wrap, you could skew each one of the elements so that they're no longer parallel with the ground on horizontal polarization. You could skew them left and right 10, 15 degrees away from parallel. It would be a very homely-looking antenna. RF-wise, it would behave the same. You could actually skew the elements a little bit where if the antenna is aimed toward the north and you take one of those elements and twist it clockwise so it's not exactly east-west. It could go from west-southwest to east-northeast, so to speak, and as opposed to east-west, and you could do quite a bit of twisting along those lines. A Yagi is a weird device. It is a mixture of dimensions and alignments, some of which are extremely critical, some of which are extremely non-critical. The exact length of every director is reasonably critical. If you're copying somebody's design and you want to get the exact same performance on 432, try to adjust the length of every element much better than a 16th of an inch on 432. You could probably make them as much as an 1/8 of an inch error on 2 meters, as long as it's not an accumulative error, as long as it's a random error. So exact length is critical. Exact position of an element, forward and aft on the boom, you could move them about an inch before anything really bad happens on 432. Again, as long as it's not cumulative. And skewing left and right on the elements, or skewing where they're twisted in either of the two planes, you'd get away with quite a bit of murder there. It'd be a homely-looking antenna. When a bird sits on your Cushcraft Yagi, which is made out of 1/8-inch diameter rods, where the rods on 2 meters are much too small in diameter, and the antenna is kind of weak, and a bird sits on some of those and bends them a little bit, you'd be amazed how much bending you can tolerate before you'll measure any significant change in performance. So the scientist in you, Joe, is worried about what this all means. I am guessing that the manufacturer of that antenna recognized the fact that one half of the dipole is a little bit hotter than the other half. He doesn't have to feed it exactly in the center, and he compensated by skewing it off to one side a little bit. Even if you moved it back and made it thoroughly symmetrical, it would make essentially no difference. Without very precise laboratory equipment, I predict you would not be able to see a change in pattern, gain, Biswar, and other kinds of performance. To B2RYY, K2RYW in the tech net.
GYN question.
GYN recognized, but Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
All right, one other thing I didn't mention to you, and I'll mention now. These are all 3/8-inch diameter elements, solid elements, and all of the elements except the driven element are directly welded to the boom. Between the center of the reflector and the center of the, I guess you'd call it director 5, the length of this is about 44 inches. So a 7-element antenna, the specification is supposed to be 10 dB over a dipole as far as gain.
Yeah, there's a whole design technique that's used by the commercial versions of Yagis where they aluminum weld the rods to the boom. An expensive process, makes a very strong antenna, and it makes an antenna that's rather good on holding its performance. We amateurs in the old days, back in the Ed Tilton Yagi days, the Ed Tilton 13-element Yagi, which came about in the late 60s, those individual elements went through the boom by simply drilling a hole in the boom and sliding this 1/8-inch diameter welding rod through the boom, and then capturing it with some kind of a saddle-like assembly with a set screw, or a set screw down the center of the boom that pressed on the element. I remember the first time I had in my hand four of those Ed Tilton Yagis, W1HDQ, I think is his call letters. He's the founder of the World Above 50 Megacycles, which in the very beginning, by the way, wasn't called the World Above 50 Megs. It was called On the Ultra Highs. They used to think 50 megacycles was an ultra high frequency. Anyhow, that Yagi, when it's first manufactured and the shiny aluminum, it's aluminum contacts on the boom, make contact, the antenna has reasonably good performance. The particular Yagis I picked up were 3 or 4 years old, had been out in the weather, and I went down the string with my ohmmeter, and I found that half of the elements made zero ohmic contact between element and boom. They had thoroughly insulated themselves by way of the aluminum oxide that built up. And as they break contact from the boom, they become electronically longer. Now the length of the element that goes through the center of the boom becomes a new series inductor, so to speak, and the element is tuned to a lower frequency, and the antenna very slowly loses its gain, and it's a very subtle thing. It's a insidious, it's a very subtle thing that happens, and you might not recognize it. So the smarter people these days either thoroughly insulate the elements from the boom in various techniques, particularly shoulder bushings are a very nice way of doing it, or mounting the elements in plastic blocks insulating blocks above the boom, below the boom, and so on. So when it comes to a small number of Yagi elements, a three or four element Yagi, the breaking contact with the boom and the detuning it has is a relatively minor factor. When you start getting into longer Yagis, like six elements and longer, in my opinion, you should never have elements that go directly through the boom, because as they break contact, and because the longer Yagi is a higher Q structure, more critical to its tuning, that tuning will change and you're almost always going to be unhappy. Mother Nature very rarely makes it suddenly fall into a higher gain performance. Okay, Mr. GYN, give me your full call letters and your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. Mr. GYN, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. The call is November 2, Gulf, Yankee, November. My name is John. And we spoke many times before. I have a question. I've done this in the past, and I've done it, but I've never taken any real measurements to find out if what I did was a good thing or a bad thing. I'm sure many of us have had elements fall off of the Yagis. And I have a 440, 430 Yagi, Chris Craft. And the last element, not the reflector, the last element in the driven, it disappeared, broke off, whatever. And what I've done is, I've done this before and I've seen other people do it. I substituted with basically a rod made from a clothes hanger and cut it exactly to the original length specifications. The thickness, the diameter is slightly different. It's thinner. But the size, the length, is exactly what the original had. What are your thoughts on that? You think it's working? I'm better off not using that last element because it was the last. It just so happened to be the last element, not any of them in a row. And we're looking at a Yagi that's about, I think, 10 or 11 elements. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the experiments I've often done when I had set up my antenna range in the backyard, and it was a ratiometry antenna range. If you want to know what that is, you can go back to the archives at ARRL and look at QST magazine. February 1978 is where I had an article on a ratiometry antenna range. But the good news about a ratiometry antenna range is that it can resolve a 20th of a decibel of gain change, 0.05 dB, can be measured reasonably accurately with that kind of a range. So during the time I was using this antenna range, I would measure how hot each director was of a particular Yagi design by moving that director forward, aft, up, down, or removing it entirely. Just take that particular director away from the whole array. And in most good Yagi designs, you remove an entire director, the gain goes down by something like half a dB. The pattern skews a little bit. By skews, I mean, I shouldn't say the word skew. The side lobes come up a little bit. The pattern changes a little bit. The gain changes a little bit. But it's not a showstopper. It's not the end of the world. It doesn't explode. So if you did nothing with that most forward director that fell off, you're still on the air. By you putting the director back in, you're coming very close back to the original performance. I didn't mention it, but when it comes to Yagi directors, parasitic elements, the lens you'd like to get as accurate as possible, better than a 16th of an inch on 432 if you want to get the original performance. And when it comes to element diameters, reasonably critical. As the element becomes more and more low in diameter, you make it skinnier and skinnier, to get the exact same electronic tuning, should make the element a tiny bit longer. Correspondingly, if you make the elements fatter and fatter, they have to be shorter. The way the Yagi works is that at each position of a parasitic element, the thing that you mount there, doesn't matter what its shape is. It can be a loop, a dipole, a square, a triangle, whatever. It could be the side view of your initials, of your name, if you know what I mean. You're putting an object there that has a certain resonant frequency to it. And if it's a director, the directors are always tuned high in frequency, which means they present a capacitive load at that position on the boom. When you're in the receiving mode of the antenna, the RF wave coming down the boom sees these parasitic elements, sees them as a bunch of individual capacitors in space. Each one has a certain position, and the magnitude of that capacitance determines how much the wave slows down. So all of your director string is a slow wave structure. The wave near the boom travels more slowly than the wave that's further away from the boom. That makes the wave, as it's coming into the antenna, have a wave front that becomes concave in shape. Concave in shape, since the wave always propagates perpendicular to the local surface, that means the wave is slowly focusing itself onto the driven element, as if there was a magnifying glass there. You're doing a focusing action. So the way you set up that slow wave structure, the exact magnitude of each one of those capacitors in free space is what determines the right amount of slow wave structure. And when you plot how slow is the wave on each position along the boom, if you made yourself a graph where the horizontal axis of the graph is positions on the boom and the vertical axis of the graph...
Reflector 9126, link clear.
I guess we've got to reset the machine periodically by letting it drop long enough. Oh well. I hope somebody's able to reset that. The vertical axis of your graph is going to be how slow is the wave in that area. And when you optimize a Yagi for a particular wavelength of Yagi, a certain number of feet of Yagi, there is an ideal velocity profile that gives you the maximum gain and the best pattern, so to speak. So each one of those directors, doesn't matter if it's fat, skinny, round, square, whatever, it has a certain resonant frequency. If it's got the right resonant frequency for your particular Yagi design, it presents just the right amount of capacitance, giving you just the right amount of slowing of the wave, which makes the wave have this concave shape as it comes in, which makes the wave from a great big chunk of space focus itself down onto the driven element. That's where all the extra area of reception is coming from. That's where the gain is coming from. So you take any one of those directors, you disturb that pattern somewhat, but it's not a showstopper. Do two or three in a row, and now you're starting to make a serious impact. So what you did is the right thing to do, as I see it, John. And if you wanted to go one step more perfect, you would either use the exact right diameter of the thing that you replaced. But your coat hanger wire being a little bit larger, a little bit smaller in diameter, in theory had to be a tiny bit longer to get right back to the exact resonant frequency, but I think you came awful close. And so what made the most forward director of your antenna break off and disappear in the first place? Did it just lose its mounting structure and slide off the antenna, John? N2GYN, KQRIW, the TechNet.
Okay, K2IRW, N2GYN. Actually, it was given to me that way. So I had a choice of putting it up that way, as you say, with the decreased gain and performance, or putting using the coat hanger wire and trying to get it back into original spec. Now, here's the thing, and I knew this when I did it. It's funny, because it might be better off if you left it alone, missing, rather than if that particular element is off. In other words, if it's too long, because I would assume as the signal is going down, now it's hitting, well, a proverbial wall and slowing down the wave, which would be detrimental more than the fact of it not being there at all. So, you know, I don't know any way of myself measuring that, except for, of course, SWR, but that's not going to tell you nothing. But it's taking a gamble. I rather try putting the element back and coming to a reasonable reasonable, what I believe to be the correct original length, because I looked it up and I cut it accordingly. But, you know, that was something I was faced with. Leave it alone and just deal with the slightly diminished performance. Put something in it that's incorrect and really hinders your performance, or get it right and bring it back to spec. Back over to you, NCGYN.
Okay, you're taking the super conservative approach here, John. Turns out you did the right thing. And even if you had it all to do over again, I'd recommend you do the same thing all over again. Let me show you what I mean by that. Let's assume you had the original most forward director there. And you started decreasing its length. You started chopping off tips of that most forward director. And eventually you would get down to zero in size, which is the same thing as removing the director entirely. You would get a very continuous, slow shift in performance. And as you remove the most forward director, you're going to lose something like half or three-quarters of a dB of forward gain. That's all. As you make it shorter and shorter and eventually eliminate it entirely, it's not a showstopper, you're half or three-quarters of a dB down in gain. That's what I discovered on the whole series of experiments I did in my backyard on this area. When you put the director back with a piece of coat hanger, because your coat hanger was a little bit smaller in diameter, for it to present the exact same reactants, you would have had to make it a tiny bit longer than the original director. So again, you were a little bit shy in length, which is equivalent to taking the original director and slowly chopping off length, and the performance slowly falls off. If eliminating the most forward director entirely loses you, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 7/10 of a dB of gain, and you put one back that's a little bit shy in length, it is my guess that you've got 6/10 of your 7/10, you got 6/10 of it back. You did the right thing. The only way you could have completely goofed it up is to make the thing you put back in so darn long that it acts like a reflector instead of a director. And now you could throw away a couple of dB of gain if you did that. But no, you did the right thing. And you were worried that getting it wrong was going to hurt. You'd have to do something really ridiculous to make it hurt compared to what you did, John. So you got it right. You did the right thing for the wrong reasons, so to speak. And good luck with your Yagi. By the way, what brand name was that Yagi that you acquired there? John, go ahead.
Yeah, it was a Chris Craft. I don't remember the model, but I think it was the 10 or 11 element. I think they're 11. I don't know why I'm saying it. 11 element. Been around for, I don't know, 30 years. Older 10. It was given to me. And, again, I had the option of repairing it or not, or attempting repair, and that's what I did. And I guess, as you say, it was the right thing to do, and something, I guess, that could be recommended to other people. Some of these antennas are, you know, they're not made no more. You can't get the parts, and you can't get the exact diameters, you know. But okay. All right, very good. Thanks for answering the question, and enjoying the net tonight. Back to you. And to GYM.
I should have asked earlier, was that a 2-meter 11-element Chris Craft Yagi? Was it on 2 meters, John?
No, 440, 430.
Yeah, the one on 2 meters, I think they use the exact same element lens, and I mean diameters. It's 1/8-inch diameter aluminum rods. And the 11-element Chris Craft, the 2-meter Chris Craft Yagi, very easy to bend those elements, have them break off and whatever. They're much too small in diameter to be a robust design. And yes, the 432 Yagi used the same diameter elements, I believe. And that particular Yagi, I think it claims to have something like 15 dB of gain. And quite often that Yagi would show up in the antenna contest and measure numbers like 9 dB. It wasn't an extremely good design. Fairly reliable, mechanically moderately good on 432, but its exact performance was never competitive compared to a well-tuned homebrew Yagi and all the antenna gain contests. The next person who signed in, there was another John, WA2 Victor Delta Hotel. Go right ahead, John, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, fine visit. Good evening to all. My question has to do with the characteristic impedance of transmission line. I've seen some formulas that for lossless lines said that Z0, I think it's the square root of L over C, the L per unit length over the C per unit length, the square root of that. I know that if the line is lossy, the characteristic impedance is no longer purely resistive, it becomes complex. My question is, how much of an error are you making by even for a lossy line, assuming that the characteristic impedance is pure real, when you go to normalize for the Smith chart, like if you have an impedance and you have to divide by the Z0, and the line is lossy, and it drops. And the line is lossy, how much of an error are you making when you do that normalization process to go onto the chart? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there are lots of electronic formulas where you do take the square root of L over C, and that's for measuring characteristics of a resonant filter, an LC. When it comes to coaxial cable, I could be wrong, but I seem to remember the formula is 276 times the log of inner diameter versus outer diameter. So the ratio of the diameters, you take the log to the base 10, multiply by 276, if I got it remembered right, and that gives you the characteristic impedance. And then in front of that, you put 1 over the square root of the dielectric constant. So if you've got a foam dielectric or a solid polyethylene, the dielectric constant of the material also lowers the characteristic impedance. When you look at lossy coax cable, the characteristic impedance does change very slowly. Until you've got a coax cable that's got a dB of loss per foot, you don't have to worry about that. If you use all of the formulas with coax cable, and you assume your coax cable is lossless when you're calculating Z0, and you also can assume your cable is lossless if you're calculating where you should put a stub tuner, if the subtuner is near the antenna. The only time you have to include the losses of the coax cable is when you've got 100 feet of cable, so to speak, going out to the antenna, and you're doing your impedance matching in the shack. Now the insertion loss of the cable will make a significant difference in the way you set up your impedance matching device in the shack. Because what's really happening whenever you've got a mismatch at the end of the cable, your RF signal coming out of the transmitter goes up the cable, experiences a little bit of loss, tries to enter the antenna. If the antenna is not presented 50 ohms as a perfect resistor, and 50 ohms reactance is not good enough, 50 ohms is a perfect resistor. If it presents any other impedance, some fraction of the RF energy you present to the antenna reflects. When it reflects, it goes back down the cable for the second time, and you experience the loss again. So the total loss you experience in the shack, as far as reflected wave is concerned, has been through the cable twice. And if your cable has had 1 dB of loss in one direction, you're going to experience 2 dB of loss on what you see as reflected power. Once you know that your cable, in my example, has got 1 dB of loss in each direction, and your reflected wave has been through 2 dB of loss, you could measure reflected power, increase it by the 2 dB, and therefore find out what is the exact reflection coefficient of the antenna. Believe it or not, if you're smart enough to know what the loss of your cable is, and you make a good measurement in the shack, you know exactly what the standing wave ratio at the antenna is, as if you had used your Visuar meter right at the antenna. Lots of people think you can't possibly make a measurement of the antenna itself anywhere except the antenna. That's not true. So, if you... except for that case of doing impedance matching in a shack, let me drop. Except for that case of doing all your impedance matching like an antenna tuner in the shack, and you're not doing it by automatic tuning, you're trying to do a bunch of calculations ahead of time with an assumed performance or assumed impedance of your antenna and a known line length and wavelength and whatever, then you have to include coax cable losses. Other than that, as I see it, John, 98% of the time, if you assume your coax cable is lossless, you'll come up with the answer that's 98% right. And that's close enough. Because you got errors in the way, in the instrumentation you use to make the measurement in the first place. So loss of cable, as long as it's not huge, dB per foot type stuff. And you would run into that, by the way, if you were using an antenna on 10,000 or 21,000 megacycles, and you're using a small diameter coax cable, you could easily run into numbers like a couple of dB of loss per foot. There, life gets a little bit more complicated. But for your and my normal circumstances, assume it's lossless, don't worry about it. The only other place where you might worry about the exact formula for insertion loss of the cable is if you were running an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna. If you knew your antenna is a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, and if you knew that your particular piece of cable under ideal conditions has half a dB of loss, and you want to calculate what is the increase in loss of the cable because it's running at a 21 standing wave ratio, a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, there you've got to include the loss factor in that particular formula. And that formula is in the ARL antenna book, the so-called excess loss of a cable with a known high standing wave ratio. They give it to you as a graph, and they also give it to you as a formula if you want the more exact one. So as I see it, John, don't lose sleep over the loss of your coax cable under most normal conditions. To the A2 Victor Delta Hotel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine, this is Dick. Yeah, what I was thinking about was the, on the right-hand side of the Smith chart where they have the lost formulas where you close down the compass, when I was doing a lost line problem where you would have a sending end circle and you'd have a receiving end circle, then the SWRs would be different because of the line lost. But I can see what you're saying. Unless I use RG58 up around a gigahertz or two. Okay, fine. This is the other question I had, a little bit more esoteric, had to do with something called electrophonic sound. I was just wondering what your opinion is about that, actually hearing. I've had a couple of experiences with it, and I was wondering if you've had any experiences with the sound produced by an actual lightning flash or a meteor trail. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, there's two or three different things you could be discussing here, John. First of all, I guess it was Dr. Eugene Frubini, roughly 1956 or so. He was working at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. He's one of the first guys who actually wrote an article on what I'm about to mention to you, where he was working on a high-power L-band radar that was running at 1,290 megacycles, and it was putting out megawatt pulses of power. But the duty factor, in other words, each pulse duration was very brief, a microsecond or so, and there was a millisecond in between, so there was like a 1,000-to-1 duty factor. When he's transmitting a megawatt of peak power out of the radar, the average power was only a kilowatt because of the pulse duration and the dead time in between the pulses. So with this kilowatt average power, megawatt peak power radar, he put his head in front of the antenna, briefly, near the feed on, and he heard a buzzing sound in the middle of his head that equaled the radar rip rate. So if the radar had a 500 pulses per second, he heard a sound in the middle of his head at 500 pulses per second, and he wrote an article on this. That was one of the direct, seemingly electronic connections between an RF wave and an acoustic function. By the same token, when a lightning bolt comes along, let me drop. Give the machine a long enough period of time to reset itself if need be. A lightning bolt, an average lightning bolt, is 11,000 amperes for something like 20 microseconds. Real big blast of power. That's an average lightning bolt. And there are super lightning bolts. Every so often your cloud doesn't have a negative charge on it, but if your cloud decides to have a positive charge, those particular lightning bolts are about 10 times bigger. Instead of 11,000 amperes, they're 100,000 amperes. Every so often you'll hear a thunderstorm in the summer where each one of the lightning bolts is super loud. really scary things. Well, that may have been a cloud that decided to be positive in charge. And how that comes about, there's a lot of theories. No one's really sure. But a positively charged cloud makes lightning bolts that are about 10 times stronger. So you get 100,000 amperes of a lightning bolt within, let's say, a fraction of a mile of where you're standing. The electromagnetic pulse it creates, the chunk of magnetic energy coming out of that lightning bolt, is so huge that it again is going to give you an acoustic sound in your head. And the acoustic sound in your head, you'll hear at the instant the lightning bolt happens, the sound that goes through the air is going to take some number of seconds to get to you, because sound only goes 1,100 feet per second through ordinary air. But the radio portion of it, the electromagnetic portion of it, travels a nanosecond per foot, six microseconds per nautical mile. It gets there so darn fast that it's instantaneous. Your eye will see the flash. Your brain will hear the electromagnetic sound instantaneously. Maybe that's the effect you're talking about, or there's even a third effect you could be talking about. So tell me which one of the facts you're talking about here before we proceed, John. Demeter VDH, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Comment?
John first, then we'll pick up comment. Go ahead, John.
It's Richie. The flash bang effect.
No, stand by, Richie. I'm asking John to give me first a definition of what he's talking about. John, W2VDH, please, go ahead.
Fine, this is, yeah. Well, let me give you the history of it. I grew up in St. Albans, and I don't know if you've ever taken the train railroad into Jamaica. There's a building, it used to be the Soul Cafe instant coffee plant. I think it's some kind of storage plant now. It's a huge building. It reminds me of Kronos, if you've ever seen that movie. Anyway, when I was a kid, I could see this building get struck regularly by lightning during a thunderstorm, and I remember occasionally that effect of seeing a lightning flash, not every time, but occasionally, a lightning flash, hearing at the instant of the flash a metallic click or metallic snap that always seemed to be coming from somewhere behind me. And then maybe a second or two later, the thunderclap. So I am talking about the lightning induced type. Although I have heard also, I did experience once. Let me let it drop. One caused by a very high meteor trail, hearing a whooshing sound at the same instant. I saw a meteor. Trail of flash. That I experienced only once. Anyway, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a number of times in which a lightning bolt strikes within a mile of my house, and at the exact same time that I see the flash out the window of the lightning bolt, I will hear a clicking sound in the shack, and I thought it was voltage jumping from point A to point B of some one of the cables in my shack. I thought that's what it was. The more that I think about it now, I'm not absolutely positive. Was that sound happening in my head, or was it happening in the shack? I vaguely remember hearing a little bit of echo off the walls of the shack. Therefore, I think it really was really a high voltage jump from point A to point B on some piece of cabling in the shack. So, now, there's the possibility that where you were standing in St. Albans when lightning struck that building, and you've got railroad tracks and power lines and all kinds of things around, that something else very near to you, like within 20 feet or so, 20 feet would be, let me think, 20 milliseconds, that's about the limit. 20 milliseconds of delay and less, you can't easily hear, the brain can't tell whether or not it's a simultaneous event or there's real delay time. It takes something like 20 milliseconds of delay before you sense that, hey, that's a real echo as opposed to a simultaneous event. So there could be some other mechanism by which the electromagnetic pulse was being coupled into railroad tracks or power wiring or whatever and arcing over something nearby in your neighborhood within 20 feet of where you're standing. That's one possibility. And another possibility is, yes, you were picking up the electromagnetic pulse in your head. And by the way, what they finally discovered, just to give you a bottom line on what you need for me to find out, which remained in mystery for about 20 years, what was the so-called psychoacoustic effect of putting your head in front of a radar? They finally discovered that it wasn't electromagnetic. You would think that the RF energy of this megawatt pulse would be rectified by some part of the nervous system of his head and give him what sounded like a sound. In reality, it really was acoustic. They finally discovered, oh, way back in the early 1990s, that that human brain material has a very high positive temperature coefficient of expansion. You heat up a human brain by a tenth of a degree or a hundredth of a degree Fahrenheit, and it expands very slightly. So you put a human head near a strong RF energy pulse. The head itself is acting a little bit like a crystal ball. It's a round, almost object of dielectric material, which tends to focus the wave at the center of your brain. At the center of the brain, the RF energy hitting there gets converted into heat. The heat creates a micro degree of temperature rise. That becomes an expansion wave, a P wave, a pressure wave in the center of your head that spreads outward and eventually hits your hearing system. And your hearing system is inside of that cranium, and it's extremely sensitive to very, very small acoustic sounds occurring within your brain. So it really was a thermal expansion phenomena happening on each individual pulse being picked up by your hearing system. So where people for years and years in all of the experiments were looking for the non-thermal effect, and when it comes to the so-called radar hearing phenomena, they thought they had found it. They soon discovered even that one was a thermal effect. So of all these 60 years of research that's been going on with radio, essentially no one has found anything except a thermal effect. RF energy hits your body, a certain percentage of it, depending on what frequency, gets absorbed and gets turned into heat, and that's it. So when you stand in front of a 30-watt transmitter, a police transmitter that's on top of a building, and you stand 10 feet away from it, you think you're at risk, you're getting an amount of thermal heating of your body that's about equivalent to standing in front of a 30-watt incandescent light bulb. Is that dangerous? I doubt it.
Repeater, time out.
For you to do something dangerous with that police transmitter, for instance, you'd have to almost put your head against the whip antenna itself. You'd have to do something really dumb. There are people who think that, hey, this is RF radiation, and I can see the antenna that's on the same roof with me, and I can walk over to it, and I'm going to put myself at great risk. You got to do something really dumb, so to speak, to convert that into a risky situation. RF energy is nowhere near as bad as you think. But that's slightly different than what you're discussing here, John, as I see it. So is there the possibility that any other wiring, any other railroad tracks or whatever, had an arcing voltage that occurred in the near vicinity of where you're standing at the instant that that lightning bolt hit that building in St. Albans? What do you think on that one, John? Then I'll pick up with Richie in a second. John first, WA2VDH, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Well, I tell you, it always did have the sound of a metallic snap, like a spark jumping, and it always seemed to be coming from somewhere behind me, about which way I was facing. I heard it my room slash shack was at that time upstairs in the attic, so I had a clear view of this building. But I would hear it downstairs. I would hear it all over under certain times. It wasn't always at every lightning strike, as you said. Only certain ones really seemed to do it. But I don't know. It could have been something off, but it had the sound of a metallic click. Go ahead.
Okay, as I hear it, John, it is possible you were getting a psychoacoustic effect, that you were getting the very strong pulse being picked up by your head and being converted into a sound. It is possible. Somehow I think it's a little bit more likely, though, that something else was arcing over nearby. But you know the timing, and I think you said it appeared to be simultaneous. and the only way something in your neighborhood could be arcing over, creating a sound, and you hear that sound, and it appeared to be simultaneous, it would have to be within about 20 feet of you, because that's 20 milliseconds approximately of acoustic delay through air, and any longer distance than that, like 100 feet away from you, would be a tenth of a second of delay for the sound.